This is the Afternoon Magazine on AM 580 WILL and online at WILL.UIUC.edu. Good afternoon. I'm Celeste Quinn. Thanks for tuning in today. You know the phrase, playing it by ear? You might say poet and writer Stephen Cousisteau lives it by ear. He's blind. His latest book is a memoir. It's about, in his words, knowing and savoring the world by ear. It's a subject that he says is impressionistic, and he describes the book as a collection of auditory postcards or tone poems. Stephen Cousisteau is the author of Eavesdropping, a memoir of blindness and listening, and he is our guest this afternoon. Listeners, I invite you to join us with questions and comments. Join us with a telephone call. The number in the Champaign-Urbana area is 333-9455. That's 333-WILL. Anywhere else, call toll-free. The toll-free number is 800-222-9455, 800-222-WILL. In addition to Eavesdropping, Stephen Cousisteau is the author of the memoir Planet of the Blind and a collection of poems, Only Bread, Only Light. He is also one of the editors of The Poet's Notebook, excerpts from the notebooks of contemporary American poets. He teaches courses in disability studies in the English department at Ohio State University. 333-9455, the number in the Champaign-Urbana area. That's 333-WILL. Anywhere else, toll-free, 800-222-9455, 800-222-9455. WILL. Stephen, good afternoon. Welcome. Thank you so much for joining us this afternoon.
Hello. Thank you for having me.
My pleasure. Well, it was a question posed to you by a woman who had recently lost her sight that led you to write this book. What was the question?
Yes, thanks. I was talking in Boston at a foundation that serves newly blinded individuals. And I was there with my first seeing eye dog. Her name was Corky. And I was giving a talk on the joys of traveling with a dog, how it, in fact, can in some cases, increase a person's sense of freedom in travel. And I got done. And this woman, who was probably really fairly young, I mean early 60s, you know, said, gone blind recently, I think, from diabetes. She said, well, why travel anywhere if you can't see? And I could feel her sadness, of course, in that question. It's a really dolorous question. And I answered, you know, in the kind of quick way that one tries to, you know, I said, well, there are really wonderful things to eat in Milwaukee, and they have, you know, great martinis in Venice, and you know, crab cakes in Baltimore. And, you know, I kind of stumbled along, but I realized I wasn't answering her question because, of course, it's a much deeper question, and it has to do with aesthetic life. How do we replace the joy, the endorphins, in fact, that we receive through the visual centers of the brain? You know, can you, in fact, really replicate that by traveling by ear? And so, of course, poets and nonfiction writers often will mull over a question like that one for quite some time, and I just kept thinking about it. And then, of course, I looked to see if there was a book by someone who was blind and and had traveled extensively and just simply recorded the joy of the listening experience. And I couldn't find such a book, so I thought, well, all right, I'll give it a try, you know, as they say in Britain, give it a go. And it became quite obvious that it would be a book without a plot, that it would be like the Seinfeld show in the sense that one would simply travel to different locations and places and write about the kind of exquisite music that happens when you're really listening in different locales.
Yeah, I was really intrigued when the book came across my desk when I saw it a few weeks back. And I'm so happy I've made its acquaintance and yours. And I hope that that woman who asked the question makes her way to this book.
Yeah, I do too. And in fact, I'm probably pretty soon going to be talking to people at the Carroll Center about making a return visit. Hopefully I can find out who that person indeed was. This happened about 8 years ago now, so that may be a bit of a trick.
Yeah.
Yeah.
During the course of writing this book, of thinking about sounds and the soundscape, did you come up with any epiphanies about listening and sound?
I did. Obviously, commencing a book like this with a background in poetry writing, as I have had, I, of course, assumed that I knew a good deal about the music of language and the ways in which poetry carries forward rhythm and, you know, obviously the exquisite sounds that come right out of the syllables that we squeeze like juice out of the, you know, the grapes of words. And I've been a lifelong ardent, listener to music. And so I thought I knew a thing or two. But, of course, what I quickly discovered is that listening to the world on its own terms, without expectations, without a kind of pre-planned agenda, that's a different thing altogether from the kind of listening we do when we're talking on our cell phones or even listening to the radio. Those are forms of listening that involve a kind of agreement for expectation. But to listen to the world unfold itself in its beautiful, neutral, unplanned, accidental ways, that's a different kind of listening, and it requires a whole different orientation. And that's where I began to find the thrill. You know, there's a section of the book where I describe going to the woods in New Hampshire and crawling around in the woods alone, crawling under big, shaggy spruce trees in the woods, you know, getting spider webs all over my face, and then sitting there all day.
Yeah.
And just listening with great attention to all kinds of sounds, the unbidden chance sounds of the woods. And in a way that I really distrust the 60s era capacity to use Zen Buddhism as a kind of analogy for any kind of concentrated experience, because Zen is a very ardent and beautiful and complex form of study. But I think to sit that way all day and listen is similar to the kind of attentive activities that Zen practitioners have. And though I am not overtly a Zen Buddhist, I'm a liberal Episcopalian. I spent a lot of time in this book, writing this book, sitting under trees or going to unfamiliar cities and sitting, you know, all afternoon just to hear the things that you can't expect. And that's actually a kind of joy.
Yeah. One of the things that you say in one of the essays, I resolved to live as much as possible like a man waking up.
Yeah. Henry David Thoreau says in one of his sections of Walden that he's never met a person who's fully awake. And, you know, I think we all talk about being fully awake, but it is a kind of consciousness that requires us to give up certain plans that we might have that occupy our attention. To be fully awake is to be tuned to things happening in the world and the universe that exceed our egos. That's not so easy. We're all worried about getting the car, you know, balanced and paying our bills and the emails we have to send, and so to go out into the world and really listen to it on its own terms. That's a different kind of art.
It's the difference between hearing and listening.
It is the difference, yeah. And there's a quote I love in the book from Stravinsky, Igor Stravinsky, of course, was a wonderful composer and impresario, and he says, to hear is no merit, he says. A duck hears also.
The first essay in the book begins with a memory from childhood. Mm-hmm. You say it is your first memory of hearing. What an interesting thing to think about and to consider. Memories are wonderful things, of course, but so often, you know, I don't tease out the senses too much.
Mm-hmm.
You know what I'm saying?
I do. One of the things I love to do when I teach creative writing is to ask students to make a long note or list of things they remember. And I borrowed that technique from a really cool American poet named Joe Brainard, who has just a long book-length list of I remember, phrases that begin I remember. And it becomes hypnotic and wonderful, you know, just all the things you remember. It makes a wonderful list. And I began playing with my memories of early sound, you know, just using the free space of a notebook, or in my case, a laptop, to just get those memories down. And the more I worked on that, the more I remembered some pretty early, you know, musical sounds. And I remembered all the way back to my childhood, which in 1958-59, formative moment in my life then, was that my family moved to Helsinki, Finland, and I remembered old women singing down by the harbor, and they were singing old folk songs in Finnish, which are striking and beautiful and strange. And that was a very early memory. And that, of course, memory and imagination are sisters. They're very close. And,
mm-hmm.
you know, once memory and imagination kind of reconnect with each other, then I felt like, I see, okay, I can write both from the past about musical events and sounds that meant something to me, and therefore foreground the contemporary part of this book, which will be about really trying to answer this woman's question from Boston. Why travel anywhere if you can't see? Well, of course, you can travel and savor things, right?
Mm-hmm.
And there's a joy in that.
Mm. How long did you live in Finland?
2 years as a child, and then a couple of years as an adult. So it's a culture I'm very warm and fascinated by. My father was a Finn.
Right.
The Upper Peninsula of Michigan.
Yeah.
So I love to go back to Finland.
Yeah. I've never been to Finland, but I love the Upper Peninsula of Michigan.
Yeah. Well, just like the UP, make sure you go to Finland in the summer.
Okay. Fall isn't bad in the UP. Spring isn't bad either.
Yeah.
Even though you're blind, you do see. What is your vision like? Tell us about that.
My vision is like that of many, many blind people. I see colors and vague shapes. You know, I think people on the street seeing a person navigating with a white cane or a dog guide often assume that that person lives inside a tree. You know, they live in a kind of complete blackness. But that really isn't the case. A considerable majority of blind people have some kind of fragments or residual versions of seeing. So I guess the analogy would be if you were to take Vaseline and rub it in your eyes. You know, in a way, that's what my visual world is like.
Hmm.
Like living inside a very impressionistic painting.
Yeah.
Yeah. In my first memoir, Planet of the Blind, I describe it as being like living inside a painting by Jackson Pollock. You know, colors and shapes.
Yeah.
And so it's, in a way, it's beautiful, but not particularly helpful.
Right, right. Well, I had to live with one eye like that for a while. I had I couldn't shut my eyelid, and I had to have ointment in there to keep it moist. It was very unpleasant. I kind of would, I don't know, I'd play with it a little bit, you know, cover the good eye and look out through the bad eye.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
This was interesting, but I'm glad everything's working all right now. When did you realize you were blind?
Well, I knew it as all people born with, you know, extremely low vision or blindness know it. I knew it as a child. The drama of my childhood, or the, you know, the narrative of it, was that my mother, knowing I was legally blind, didn't want me to be blind. The rural New Hampshire town where I grew up in the late 50s, early 60s, was not accepting of disabled kids, particularly, you know, in the realm of public school. And so my mom was very adamant that she was going to get me into public school. And in the process of creating that triumph, it's a civil rights triumph maybe, but she also kind of gave across this very direct sense that, you know, you got to repress the blindness. And therefore, she sent mixed messages, right? Don't be blind. Try as hard as you can to act like normal people. Well, you know, that's not a very good way to live. And, of course, people who are blind and visually impaired, many will tell you that they've had a similar experience, particularly in that era. You know, the Americans with Disabilities Act of 1990 was a really great breakthrough in this country. It allowed people with disabilities just a much stronger foothold in mainstream culture. It's hard to imagine that, you know, just over the last 40 years, what a transformation we've undergone.
Yeah.
You know, I like to think that today President Roosevelt would not have had to hide his disability.
Right. What did your mom's denial mean for you?
Well, children interpret the sadness of adults in, you know, complex ways. Mm. And so I think on a very profound level, I felt a sense of shame that I was, you know, different. I also had a great deal of reckless, outgoing abandon so that I, you know, didn't sit alone and feel the shame. I plunged into the world, and I'm glad for that. But it took me a long time to really begin to understand that to be blind and to be a, you know, fully, overtly blind citizen on the street with your white cane or your dog is really a joyous kind of experience. It took me a long time to get there.
Yeah.
And, you know, there's an abjection, to use a word that's popular in higher education and humanities courses. Women know that objection, and people of color know that objection. You know, there are powerful engines in society that, you know, underscore what being normal in a preferred way is all about. And children can absorb that. It's very hard for kids with disabilities, too, because other children can be cruel.
Yeah.
You know, that I detail a good deal of that in the first book, Planet of the Blind. I also talk about it a little bit in Eavesdropping. You know, one of the things that I did living in rural places like New Hampshire and Finland was to find ways to have introspective but adventurous time by myself as a blind kid. And that comes out in both of those books.
Yeah.
Yeah.
In Eavesdropping, I love the, I think it's the second essay. It's titled Horse. Confident little guy you were, just headed right out.
That's right.
Right outside.
I describe going out one morning while my parents are asleep and walking through the woods and getting wonderfully lost and winding up at the nearby university's horse barn and going into that barn and not being able to see the horse but knowing he's there and finding my way to him. It's a section that I enjoyed writing. And at one point I go, "Where are you, horse?" Yeah.
Yeah. You write, the ending is, "At night when I couldn't sleep, I thought of this horse. I thought of his glory, his fat sound. I thought of how he pinched the air around him with his breathing. The house and the trees swayed in the night wind. The horse was dry wood talking. He was all nerves and nostrils. He tightened and then unwound like a clock. He groaned like the Finnish women who stood beside the ocean waving their sticks."
Yeah. That was a beautiful horse.
Yeah.
I also describe him as, you know, making noises that sound like water gurgling in the back of a boat.
Yeah.
He also sounds like an ocarina.
Right.
He's breathing in and out.
Holding his breath.
And at one point he holds his breath. Yeah, that's right. I think he was trying to hide from me.
And then you're...
Who knew that horses sometimes hold their breath?
I didn't know that.
Yeah.
Yeah. Anyway. And here again we have the Finnish women who come from the first essay, who you talked about a moment ago in their singing.
Yeah, they come back in that moment, yeah.
Yeah. Strophe and anti-strophe. And that...
And what the Finnish women did was to beat their carpets. They would hang their indoor carpeting from racks, you know, that look like, you know, swing set structures down by the ocean, and then they would beat these carpets with wooden bats. And so they would go down there and beat their carpets, you know, in this chill Arctic air and sing these ancient folk songs in rhythm with the, you know, the percussiveness of striking the dirt out of their carpets.
Yeah. Step, rhythm, pulse, beat. I'd crossed a threshold, hearing and walking the uncertain space that opened before me. And here this idea of strophe and antistrophe, am I pronouncing that correctly?
Yeah, those are Greek.
But they're also terms from poetry, yes?
Yeah, we talk about strophe and antistrophe within the area of poetry where we're thinking of the stresses in language, stressed and unstressed. Syllables in poetry, yeah.
And also from, as you said, the ancient Greek chorus.
Right, and it also ties to dancing, which the Greek chorus would do while they recited.
A kind of back and forth.
Yeah, right.
Yeah.
Right.
When you were a little guy, you know, having a moment like this, were you able to return home and talk about it and have someone listen to you?
No, I kept a lot of this inside. You know, it was the building of an interior world for the most part.
Yeah.
You know, my parents would say, "Where were you?" And I'd say, "Oh, in the woods."
Yeah.
You know, that was a good enough explanation.
Yeah.
You know, it's funny, people would say to me, "Well, how was it that your parents let you wander around so much and you were a blind child?" And I really honestly think that the answer to that has something to do with the fact that back in the late 1950s and early 60s, all parents let their children wander around. It wasn't really an uncommon thing to let your kid out and they would just wander.
Yeah.
You know, today we have a much more, and perhaps correctly so, we have a much more controlled sense of, you know, neighborhood and concern and care for where our children go because... you know, we sense that the world is potentially dangerous, and I think, you know, 40 years of television has done a lot to, you know, underscore that for parents. But you talk to plenty of people in my age group, certainly, you know, I'm in my early 50s, you know, most people will say, yeah, our parents just never worried about us. We went out all day.
Yeah, in the summertime you went out, I went out, we all went out all day. We might show up somewhere for lunch, and then we were off again until it was... dark.
Exactly. I think kids today have a different world, which I lament.
Yeah.
There's magic out there.
Yeah. Well, there's so many organized activities for kids to take part in today that we didn't have anything like that.
Yeah.
Unless it was, you know, doing it on your own, getting a group of kids together to do something. Like fall into the creek or play baseball, that kind of thing.
Right.
Yeah. This is The Afternoon Magazine. Our guest this afternoon, poet and writer Stephen Kusisto. His latest book is Eavesdropping, a Memoir of Blindness and Listening. Listeners, I invite you to join us this afternoon with questions, comments. Join us with the telephone call. The number in the Champaign-Urbana area is 333-9455. That's 333-WILL. Anywhere else, toll free 800-222-9455. 800-222-WILL. So, what was school like for you?
Well, school was difficult for me. I was mainstreamed into public school, but of course, in the era when that wasn't a commonplace thing for kids with disabilities, and I didn't have the kind of support or help that would have made that a, you know, good and positive experience. So I had to do a lot of listening and had to get a lot of help from classmates and things of that nature. So when I think back to, you know, my childhood schooling, I remember a lot of tension. You know, it was a real hard experience getting by in that way.
Did you have friends?
I did. I've always been an outgoing sort of person, and I love to talk, and I love to tell stories, and, you know, so I'm, you know, I don't mean to sound self-absorbed in this way, but I'm comparatively amusing to spend time with.
You're a good companion.
Yeah. So, you know, it may help that my mother was Boston Irish, you know, so I've got this gift of malarkey, you know, and consequently, I had friends. Yeah. I did.
Let's talk with some listeners now.
Oh,
first,
good.
First, we're going to talk with a caller calling in on a cell phone, line one. Hi.
Hello. I just had a comment. We have some friends, a couple, where they both are blind, and we were visiting them, and we had a Prius, and it really sort of freaked out our friends because you don't hear the engine running all the time.
Right.
And
right.
If you're backing up in it, it has this little thing that beeps inside the car to tell the driver, be careful, someone might not know you're moving. But I don't know why they don't have that on the outside to warn people whether they're sighted or not.
Mm-hmm.
And there's more and more cars that are made that are hybrid. And I just was wondering if anything would be done to, you know, be able to alert people.
This is a topic of some interest in the blind community, as you can imagine. And I know that the dog guide schools in the United States, and there are several very good ones, they're all sister organizations, though they're separate. They're all nonprofit agencies. But I know that several of the dog guide schools, the Seeing Eye in Morristown, New Jersey, Guiding Eyes for the Blind in Yorktown Heights, New York, where I got my dog, Leader Dogs for the Blind in Rochester, Michigan, Guide Dogs for the Blind in San Rafael, California. Many of these organizations are working together on tackling this very issue because electric cars indeed make no noise, and therefore they make orientation and mobility concerns for the blind, you know, far more evident.
Mm-hmm.
We listen to traffic as blind people, you know, in order to make decisions about crossing the street. So this is an issue, and I think it will ultimately, the issue of how to identify those cars, will probably be resolved because it's a serious enough issue that probably some federal guidelines under the Americans with Disabilities Act will be adopted. So
that would be good.
Yeah, I think so.
Thank you.
Yeah, you're welcome.
Next, we talk with a listener in Champaign on line two. Hi.
Good afternoon. It's my pleasure to listen to you today. My question would be, given the ignorance and the prejudice and the bias that we have in our society, what's your driving force? Makes you, have the competitive spirit that I hear, or I have heard here. What kind of makes your crank go? Or
yeah, that's a good question. I think it's a complicated answer because, you know, I mean, one thing I have said to many people along the road of life is that, you know, I got involved in writing because, you know, as a kid with a disability, I couldn't play baseball. And I think baseball is a fantastic thing. And I often will also say to the same people that if I could see, I think I would have loved to have been a shortstop. But story writing, that was something I could do. And, of course, I found pleasure in story writing, even early. began typing. My mom got me a typing teacher, and I could type, and you know, I couldn't necessarily read what I was typing, but other people could. And you know, over time, I realized that writing is a kind of not only pleasure, but in fact, it can be a kind of career. And I got to college and discovered that, lo and behold, one could take courses in writing, you know, from contemporary living, breathing writers. And that was just unbelievable to me. I just couldn't believe, I just felt like I'd found the candy store.
Well, I just want you to know that you are an inspiration to us all.
Oh, thank you.
Thanks for the call. Other questions, comments are invited. 333-9455, the number in the Champaign-Urbana area. Anywhere else, toll-free 800-222-9455. When did you discover poetry? Tell us about listening to Milton.
There is a section in Eavesdropping where I describe, I think somewhat comically, I hope, having a junior high school music teacher, a substitute teacher, turn up one day, and he knew nothing about music. It was his intention to read aloud the poetry of John Milton to a room full of adolescent boys. And, of course, this is a kind of wonderful, kooky, sweet, misguided, demented activity. And, you know, it struck me as being really oddly beautiful. He took a lot of abuse, I think, from those boys, but he was passionate about Milton. And I then went home and got from the Library of Congress Talking Books Library for the Blind John Milton's Paradise Lost on records, and listened to it with great interest. And so I probably around the time that I, you know, what are you in the, you know, in the 8th grade, 7th grade, you know, 13, 14, I was really starting to get it that poetry was really pretty interesting. And then when I was in high school, I went to a little tiny, we lived in a little tiny town in western New York at the time called Geneva, New York, and I was in high school. And there's a very good undergraduate four-year liberal arts college there called Hobart and William Smith. And a good poet who taught there on the faculty came and visited our high school English class one day, and he read aloud contemporary poets, James Wright and Adrian Rich and Charles Simic and wonderful poets, you know. And I thought, oh my gosh, this is really great.
Yeah.
And then I, you know, from there I was hooked.
When did you discover Walt Whitman?
I didn't discover Walt Whitman until I got into college.
Really?
And probably, you know, somewhere in my sophomore year, I took a, you know, 19th century American literature course, and Leaves of Grass was on the syllabus. And, of course, I found in Whitman a wonderfully optimistic, interesting mind. He loves everything about being alive.
Mm-hmm.
You know, your toes, your hair, the smell of hay, the sounds of, you know, carriages in the streets. I mean, he is just an ecstatic, visionary poet. And I loved that. I loved that about him. I loved his great joy at being a conscious, living being and the way that he seeks to transmit that to his readers. Whitman is a real treasure.
Yeah. Let's talk with another listener, someone waiting for us in Urbana on line one. Hi.
Hi. I've been honored to listen to this conversation.
Oh, great. Hello.
Thank you. I'm a dog person, and you mentioned briefly that you have a guide dog. Is that true?
I do. I have a guide dog right now, and then my former guide dog retired a few years ago,
mm-hmm.
and she passed away last spring. And
so you you had her with you even.
I did, and I have her ashes in a beautiful urn, and I talked to her.
Well, I wondered if you've written some essays, and if you could just describe a little bit about your life with your dog, in a way that you talk about other things. I mean, not practical, but just sort of
mm-hmm.
physical and.
There is a chapter in the new book, Eavesdropping,
mm-hmm.
about traveling around with my guide dogs, plural,
mm-hmm.
Called Dog Man, the action figure.
Okay.
I start off by talking about how my stepson, you know, when he was smaller, really loved these, you know, plastic heroes, you know, with the movable arms and different attachments that you can give them, laser swords and things like that. And how one day he explained to me that, you know, there's a difference between an action figure, he says, and a superhero. He's explaining this difference. Uh-huh. Action figures have, you know, special tools and accoutrements that they carry. And so I begin to think of myself as Dog Man, the action figure, because I travel with a dog and become a six-legged creature.
Oh, yes. I see.
And, you know, I have a lot of fun with that idea.
Yeah.
And okay. Also my first book, Planet of the Blind, which is still in print and available everywhere, has a long section in it about the discovery of a guide dog and getting my first one. Okay. Her name was Corky. She was a big yellow Labrador, and describes, you know, the first walk with Corky, and then obviously increasing discoveries of her loyalty and reliability as we travel together all sorts of places.
We have a local writer that I can't think of her name now, Beth. Finky,
yes. Beth Finky, yeah.
She's
a wonderful writer.
Her experience, yeah. It took her, like, I don't know, 5 years to write the book. It started out being maybe 2 or 3 inches thick, and it took her forever, but it's a wonderful book, and maybe you've already read it.
I have.
Yeah. Well, thank you very much.
Oh, you're welcome.
Wonderful to talk to you.
Great.
Bye.
Thanks for the call this afternoon. Another thing about Corky is you think of her as being... Well, the two of you, you know, that action figure thing, but also Greek and heroic and centaur.
Yeah, although I try to be kind of philosophical about this, you know, particularly in eavesdropping, because guide dogs are keenly trained to assist their blind partners, but the blind person is the one in control who's making all the decisions about where to go. And, you know, I think the public may imagine that blind people are being led by these dogs in some kind of, you know, robotic, you know, can one say unsentient way? And that's not the case at all. You know, the dog is trained to help the blind person make good judgments about traffic. But, you know, you're the rider of the horse. And, you know, it is true that the dogs can make heroic choices and be wonderful and really superb companions. But I guess what I'm trying to say is that there is a section in eavesdropping where I'm careful to sort of underscore what kind of a hero a guide dog is. They make great decisions, and they're wonderful, beautiful creatures. But, you know, their disabled partners aren't like Little Nell tied to the railroad tracks. It's not that kind of heroism.
Right.
More complex one.
Yeah.
Yeah.
That
makes sense?
Yeah.
Oh, good.
One ought to think of me as a six-legged being, for I am both a man and a dog. But of course that's not exactly right. I'm a capable blind man who travels everywhere with a trained dog. And after you wrote this piece, the first sentence is, I have just returned from a trip that took me to many cities. Three cities in 6 days, right?
Right.
Yeah. That's a lot.
That's a lot of traveling, yeah.
Yeah.
My two guide dogs have done a lot of flying, which for your audience means they come on the plane with me, lie at my feet.
Yeah.
But yeah, they've flown a lot of places. In fact, I have a photograph right here by the phone on the wall that my wife put up of she and I and my first dog, Corky, sitting in a gondola in Venice.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And that photo is on your website.
It is, yeah.
Connie
put it on the website.
Yeah. And also, at your website, people can find some excerpts from the two memoirs and from the Book of Poems.
Exactly.
Right. Only Bread, Only Light is the collection of poems. And so let me tell our listeners where to find you.
Oh, great.
On the web. And it's simply your name. It's www.stephen with a PH, Stephen, and then Kusisto. I hope I'm...
Yep.
Okay, good. That is spelled KUUSISTO.com.
com. Yeah.
Or I suppose also you could put in at a books site, you could put in eavesdropping or only bread, only light, and your name would come up there too. So if
right.
folks aren't, you know, don't have a pencil or pen at the moment at the handy, you know, put that in and you'll get to Stephen's website. Before we run out of time, I want to talk with you a little bit about the essay that you wrote in the book that has to do with your love of baseball and some of the wonderful things that you have experienced in ballparks in terms of just listening to your fellow fans.
Yeah. Yeah, that section of the book is called Inside the Fence, and it's about going to baseball parks, stadiums, you know, over a 25-year period. And they're all just little, like I said, or you said before, they're audio postcards. And, you know, you go to the ballpark, and, you know, you hear fans talking, and there's just an exquisite, beautiful, idiomatic, jazzy language that Americans speak and that the poet William Carlos Williams celebrated in much of his work. And, you know, I just simply recorded all of this over a long period. So you hear fans, you know, razzing the umpires, you know, and you hear fans talking about where they want to travel next, and fans relating hilarious stories about things that have occurred to them. And then I switch on the radio and listen to the ball game through the radio broadcast through headphones, and I switch back and forth between the radio game and, you know, the peculiar inattentiveness of the fans who are out there, in a way, experiencing the game visually, but also feeling free to ignore it. And so there are many kinds of baseball going on in the ballpark.
Mm-hmm.
And I love that.
Yeah.
You know, I mentioned that baseball as a 19th century pastoral game probably was, in fact, popular with people because it's slow, because you can go and watch the game but talk to each other. And then suddenly you hear the ball and there's something going on and you look quickly and then you look away and go back to talking about what's happening at the neighbor's house and gossiping, you know.
Yeah.
And nowadays, Major League Baseball is trying to cover that up by making every second in the ballpark amplified
yeah.
with advertising and lots of loud rock and roll, so that between pitches, you know, you're even hearing bits of rock and roll. And they're trying to make the game contemporary for young people who, you know, live in the MTV generation.
Yeah.
And I think they're destroying some of the kind of pastoral nuttiness of baseball for the crowd.
Yeah.
But in any event.
Yeah, it's a stadium now, not a park.
Yep, that's yeah. right.
Let's talk with one more listener, before we run out of time here. Caller in Urbana, line one. Hi.
Hi. Good afternoon.
Well, hello.
It's a cold, rainy one here in Urbana.
It is here in Ohio, too.
Could you draw a parallel between blind poets and blind musicians? Most blind musicians are folk artists, and the list is legion.
Yeah, it is.
It's very difficult for blind classical musicians to memorize and not read music.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
So folk tunes can be memorized, but do you think there's a... Well, draw the parallel. Anyway, I appreciate the whole show. Thank you very much.
Oh, you're welcome. Well, that's an interesting question. In order to read music, there is a kind of Braille notation for music, but it is a very difficult thing for, you know, a blind classical musician to work in that kind of professional way. Not impossible, but not easy. And it is true that there have been many, many blind folk musicians, both here and abroad, around the world, and one, of course, there is a long list. I tend to think of music and poetry and the issue of blindness in a kind of broad way. No pun intended, Broadway. I think that Stevie Wonder is a great musician because he is a great musician, and that his blindness happens to be a kind of odd incidental dimension to the situation. Which is to say, I also think that Paul McCartney is a great musician because he is a great musician and not because, you know, he's cute or comes from Liverpool. And I think that's the case, that the people who are blind who become great musicians You know, Ray Charles is another wonderful example. It's because they have that imaginative and, you know, emotional drive toward music. And that, just as I had it toward writing. But I don't think it was the blindness that made that happen.
Mm.
You know, I think it's quite possible. I joke about how I might have liked to have been a baseball player. But it's also the case that had I 20/20 vision, I might still be a poet. The joy of language would have been there, too.
Mm.
And I like to underscore that for people because, you know, I think that we forget when we see a person with a disability, Yitzhak Perlman, you know, great violinist, for example, who has polio. We say, oh, isn't it wonderful? He's got this compensatory gift. But I think they have a great gift. And that the disability is a secondary thing, and I try to underscore that,
yeah.
both for myself and for other people.
Yeah. Well, that's a good point, I think, to depart here. We got to wrap it up. We're out of time. Thank you. It's just been a pleasure talking with you, Stephen.
Oh, thank you. Thanks for having me.
My pleasure. Stephen Cosisto has been our guest in this portion of the Afternoon Magazine. His latest book is Eavesdropping, a Memoir of Blindness and Listening. He is also the author of the memoir, Planet of the Blind, and a collection of poems, Only Bread, Only Light. He's also one of the editors of The Poet's Notebook, excerpts from the notebooks of contemporary American poets. The new book, Eavesdropping, published by W.W. Norton.